This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Sustainability has become a buzzword as corporations, individuals, families, and municipalities seek to find more ways to save resources. The process also saves money. Appalachian State University is in the midst of a decades-long commitment to sustainability. They've held energy summits to spread ideas and best practices throughout the University of North Carolina system, and as a result, are on track to save the state $1 billion in avoided energy costs by 2020. It's a model that university systems nationwide could duplicate. App State just held their annual Appalachian Energy Summit, and we're going to talk about what the university has done to become more sustainable and how it has affected faculty, staff, students, and taxpayers. Jed Moody is Special Assistant to the Chancellor for Sustainability at Appalachian State and Director of the school's annual Energy Summit. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for being here. And Michael Lizotte is the University Sustainability Officer at UNC Charlotte. He previously held a similar position at the University of Wisconsin Oshkosh, where he was also a professor of ecology and helped found the Environmental Studies Program. Thank you for returning to the program. Nice to have you here.
Thank you, Mike.
This is a fifth annual Energy Summit. For the first time, you're opening it to other universities around the country. Is that to say that North Carolina and specifically Appalachian State University are ahead of the curve in this area?
One of the ways that we're ahead of the curve is in the statewide collaboration. So there's lots of people out there in higher education doing good work. What's unique about the Appalachian Energy Summit is the whole UNC system and six private schools in North Carolina are coming together to work collaboratively. So this year we've invited campuses and individuals from across the country to come in and learn from us in hopes that they might build a similar collaborative network.
And how many of those campuses and universities have responded to the call and are in attendance?
We'll have an additional 15 campuses from outside of the state, plus the 17 campuses of the UNC system, plus six private schools in North Carolina.
Now, you know, we've talked a lot on this program about sustainability, and usually we've focused in on homeowners, we've focused in on business owners, we've focused in on municipalities and how they do business. Is this a relatively new thing for universities to be thinking about being more sustainable?
Well, actually, higher education is kind of at the epicenter of the sustainability movement. One, it's driven by the students who are demanding a better future. You have the academics who are spending lots of time and energy researching in these areas. So for decades, campuses across the country, in my opinion, have been leaders in this movement because the campuses represent these microcosms where you can really work on everything you do.
Yeah, campuses teach this as a course of study. You've taught this as well, Dr. Lizotte, as a course of study. I'm sure you do it at UNC Charlotte. You did it at the University of Wisconsin in Oshkosh. Isn't it just a natural progression for campuses to be involved in this sort of thing?
Yeah, and I'd also add to the list that Jed was saying, the external pressure that we have from employers. We now have a case where practically all of the Fortune 500 companies do sustainability reporting. They need staff to do that work. They need energy managers. And the universities have already been trying to respond to producing those degree programs and those graduates.
And when you have programs like that and you have students in the classrooms learning about this every day, do they become evangelists for the cause, so to speak, within their own university system?
Certainly that happens from the first day they come on campus. They often arrive with some evangelical fervor. And so a lot of what we do on campus, I think, is focusing and showing them how professionals get this kind of work done, and help them make that transition so that it can be part of whatever career they take. Some campuses, Appalachian State's actually a great model, are really going campus-wide with this idea so that no matter which field you go into, you're going to be prepared to bring sustainability to your company, to your community.
As I said in the beginning, App State's been doing this for decades, and I guess I'm going to take a leap of faith here and say that I'll bet you it had something to do with the fact that you're in the mountains, and there are a lot of people up in the mountains who are very concerned about the environment and the ecology.
Well, people that find their way to the mountains, I think, have a natural love for the environment. Mm-hmm. And sustainability is about environmental sustainability, it's about economic sustainability, and it's about social sustainability. So we have attracted over decades people with these sensibilities. And now, as Mike said, the idea of sustainability has found its way into our curriculum very deeply. We have classes in every curriculum, and we have professors in every discipline doing research that is either focused or related.
How did this start? Because this has been going on for, what, 20, 25 years up there? How did this start? Why did it start there?
It started with individuals that had a passion. For decades, you've been able to come to Appalachian State University and get a degree in sustainable development. You've been able to get a degree in renewable energies technology. And again, this sensibility has just found its way into every discipline. So, you know, if you're a professor in biology, you know, they're looking at ways to sustain the environment. If you're a professor in building science, for decades, they've been focused on how to build sustainable buildings. And so it really does have a place in each and every discipline.
There are people, even after years of conversation about this, who basically will look at this and say, oh, it's just a bunch of tree huggers. What's the big deal? Well, the rubber meets the road at the dollar sign, I think. And I said in the beginning that you're on track after only 4 years to save the university system a billion, that's with the B, $1 billion in saved energy costs by 2020. And then if I read this correctly, $2 billion by 2025. Put that number into perspective.
Well, anytime you can use the B word, you get
you get their attention.
You get people's attention. You get the media's attention. You get the legislature's attention. There's lots of benefits to sustainability. But when we can put it into financial terms, which are so important right now, it really helps people understand, as you said, that it's not just tree huggers.
Mm-hmm.
And these are major societal issues. You look at North Carolina. We have, in some pockets of North Carolina, you know, 30 and 35% of children that are hungry. I mean, we have lots of societal issues in North Carolina. And when we can talk about sustainability as driving this level of economic activity, then we think it helps people understand that this is not just good for the environment, it's good for everyone.
So did I get the numbers right? It's $1 billion by 2020, $2 billion by 2025. That's an exponential growth. I'm not a mathematician, but it sounds exponential to me.
Well, to be clear, it's a cumulative number.
Okay.
So $2 billion will be the amount we've saved. So you know, what you can say is between 2020 and 2025, we will save $1 billion. But this past year, we had $103 million in savings across the system. And that number gets, as you said, larger every year.
And you're saving this money for the university system because the university system is listening to you. They're putting into practice things that you have suggested over the years and that you've tried on your own campus at Appalachian State?
Well, the beauty of the Energy Summit is we take ideas from each and every campus and we bring the best practices to light. So we don't claim to have all the good ideas, but what we do claim is that we're quick to spot them, quick to implement them. But there's great things happening at every campus and a lot of great things at UNC Charlotte as well.
Well, in fact, UNC Charlotte has one of the lowest energy consumption rates in the entire university system. How did that happen? Why is that?
Yeah, so that's something we measure, for example, how much energy per square foot you have in buildings. And I'll be honest, one of the big benefits we have is we're one of the youngest campuses and the fastest growing. So over the past decade, I think UNC Charlotte is responsible for half of the growth in the UNC system. It all happened right here. So that means we have lots of newer buildings. Newer buildings tend to be greener, more efficient, better materials, and so modern technologies. And so I'll be completely honest. The older established campuses have the challenge of their legacy buildings,
right,
and bringing those up to date. And we need the legislature to support that, you know, bringing those up to date. So being one of the youngest and newest built out campuses, we in some ways can show where the other campuses need to be.
Mm-hmm.
once their buildings are upgraded.
Well, I don't know that you can speak for the entire campus. You're not the chancellor. But let me ask you, when you do build a new building at UNC Charlotte, is it all – I know the one downtown, the downtown building, is a LEED certified building. Do you aim for that? Do you request that kind of money from the legislature to build those kinds of buildings? Or do you just do the best with what you're allowed to do?
So this is probably a good entry to mention that a lot of this is driven by goals that are set by the legislature. Mm-hmm. And in fact, one of the things that we're trying to get to the point now in advertising the savings we've made so far to the system is we need new challenge goals from the legislature because we've largely met the goals they set for us back in 2003. They had some landmark legislation that's just gave us the goal and then left us to be entrepreneurial and solve the problem, and we showed we're capable of doing that.
2003, if I remember my history correctly, that was a Democratic legislature. Are you likely to get the same kinds of goals, ambitious goals, from a Republican legislature? Because the impression is they aren't as concerned with environmental issues, particularly if they cost money, as the Democratic legislature was.
So I think part of the challenge here is we do need investment, and I would hope that Republicans understand mm-hmm. investment with future payoff as well as anybody of any political stripe. So I think we should be able to get this message through that good strong investment in UNC system in modernizing buildings is going to have these long-term payoffs. And that's why, again, going back to the Appalachian Energy Summit, it really helped us get together and even get help from NCDNR mm-hmm. to really track the cost savings, really track those energy savings so that we trust those numbers. So we have not left it to every campus to sort of find numbers themselves. We've been trying to do it in very uniform ways. Those numbers can be trusted. Mm.
You've been nodding over there, Jed Moody. Obviously, you know this as well as Dr. Lizotte knows it.
Well, I'm compelled to speak to the kind of political nature of the issue that you brought up. Being stewards of energy is not a Republican or a Democratic issue. And so, when you hear sustainability issues being pulled into that political spectrum, one of my goals is to pull it out of that spectrum. We're not building efficient buildings because we're Democrat or Republican. We're building it because it's the right thing to do. It saves the state money. And this perception that it costs way more to build a green building is just simply not true anymore. If an architect tells you it costs a lot more to build a green building, then you probably don't have an architect that's very well schooled in how to build these buildings and how to build them well and on budget. Because the reality is they save you money over time. So it's, as Mike said, it's an investment. It might cost you a small increment more to build it, but it will pay you back many times over through the life of the building.
That's Jed Moody, who's the Special Assistant to the Chancellor at Appalachian State University and the Director of the Appalachian Energy Summit, which is underway on the campus up there. He's joining us with Dr. Michael Lizotte, who's the University Sustainability Officer at UNC Charlotte. And we're going to talk about how you achieve all these billions of dollars in savings at the university system all over the state, and a lot more as we go through the program at Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Gerald Melberg Gallery, currently presenting a survey exhibition for the abstract expressionist artist Robert Motherwell, celebrating the 100th anniversary of his birth. Located on South Sharon Amity Road, information at geraldmelberg.com. Coming up tomorrow on Charlotte Talks, with the Link's Blue Line, Charlotte's Center City has been extending its reach outward towards South End. Condos, apartments, and businesses are evidence of that, and now live theater is joining the migration. We'll hear from one company that has been experimenting with productions in South End and meeting with success. That's first, then we'll meet the bass player for The Accomplices, who will play this weekend at the Whitewater Center. We'll talk about music and skin-on-frame kayaks. That's all when Charlotte Talks tomorrow at 9 on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, according to a recent national poll, businessman Donald Trump has a double-digit lead in the Republican presidential field. What's behind his strong appeal?
Stay tuned for the Diane Rehm Show coming up next from 10 to noon, right after Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins on listener-funded public radio, where 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about energy savings. We're talking about sustainability. Jed Moody is the special assistant to the chancellor at App State University. Dr. Michael Lazat is the university sustainability officer with UNC Charlotte. The cost of higher education is a big, big topic in the world today. It's a big topic, a big concern for parents, probably an even bigger concern for students who leave schools with a mountain full of debt. It's a big concern for state legislatures around the country who are grappling with finding ways to fund university systems, etc. How will the $1 billion in sustainability generated savings that you've achieved impact those costs? Figured?
When we got started, the University of North Carolina system has 221,000 students. And we spend $226 million a year on energy. And so that's about $1,000 per student per year. So you talk about an opportunity. You think, what does it cost me to send my son or daughter to college for a year? And you think, wow, $1,000 of that just went to energy and utilities. So it's a tremendous opportunity. And the billion or the $2 billion that we'll save by 2025 is money that is there for the universities to lower costs, to build a better campus, to provide an education, and it's also dollars that flow back in to the state as well that help offset tax collections.
You know, when we talk about sustainability, we talk about building sustainable buildings, we talk about retrofitting older buildings, we talk about things as simple as turning up the thermostat in the summertime, turning it down in the wintertime, not letting the water run while you brush your teeth, things like that. What do you do at the university level to accomplish those kinds of savings? It's more than just putting old incandescent bulbs out to pasture, I'm sure.
Well, let's tackle that one first, because that's one that the public really can understand. You know, how many light bulbs do you want to change? One of the things that's happened even just in the relatively short career that Jed and I have had these titles of sustainability officers is we've seen lighting go from incandescent bulbs to the fluorescents and now to the LEDs. So on my campus last year, one of our accomplishments with the help of contractors was changing another 30,000 lamps, light bulbs, to go to that most efficient new LED technology.
Now, I try to do that when an incandescent bulb burns out. I try to go to Lowe's or the Home Depot and buy some of these new LED bulbs. Now that they've gotten the color temperatures fairly right and they don't look odd when you put them in a lamp, but they're so expensive. I mean,
right.
Is the expense over time going to balance out the initial investment?
So you're buying a consumer product.
Right.
And so I'll just say, this is one of the reasons why larger corporations, institutions can move faster on this. Obviously, when we're buying 30,000 units, we get a really good price. So we do have an edge over the consumer who is going out and trying to replace a single light bulb. Those are advantages, and those are advantages that all large corporations are taking right now is to run the costs out the way we do business.
And I'm sure that you're buying bulbs that are high-intensity bulbs for parking lots and building lighting and things like that, in addition to classroom lighting and things like that. But when you're talking about a light bulb that burns 65 watts of electricity to put out X number of lumens, and you can put the same number of lumens out for 12 watts, over 30,000 light bulbs, that's a big savings, isn't it?
Yes, yes. And so that's – and it also – I will say one of the reasons that campuses and corporations and most building managers will go for the light bulbs first is it's very easy to calculate your savings because it's just the amount of time that bulb runs and you can do that. We are a little more challenged when we try to improve heating and cooling because people can change thermostat levels because that's a lot more dependent on the weather, here in Charlotte, we're all going to get our electric bills pretty soon and see what that heat wave cost us. So those are a little bit more difficult to calculate. And I think in some ways that's the place where we're really starting to make a contribution is how to do that accounting.
Well, you bring up an interesting point because it's not just replacing light bulbs. Those are the things that you can control. There are things that you can't control. So you got to get people on board to buy into this and follow through, do you not?
Yeah. I'm going to go there in 1 second, but okay. The light bulbs seem expensive. Shop around, buy them on sale. And when you look to replace light bulbs, start with the ones that are on all the time. The bulb that burns 12 hours a day or the one that sits on your front porch on all night. Mm-hmm. Bulbs that are on often will pay for themselves. On our campus, when we replace a light bulb, it oftentimes pays for itself in under a year. So it sounds expensive, but you have to figure the cost. So buy them on sale. Look for the ones that are on often.
And the life of these bulbs is enormous.
20 years.
Yeah. You may never have to buy another one.
Yeah.
Well, that's the other thing. We've even seen a good example is we were looking at a pool, an indoor pool. And you actually have to drain the pool and bring in all this special equipment just to change the light bulbs. So colleges are starting to estimate tens of thousands of dollars in savings just because you don't have to do that kind of thing to change a light bulb because it lasts long.
But to your question before, it's not just light bulbs. Most of our energy is in being in the mountains is through heat. Mm-hmm. We actually, spend more energy BTUs on natural gas than we do electricity. So we put a lot of time and thought into how to make the buildings more efficient. All of the HVAC systems, they have giant motors that we now run at variable speeds versus full on. We look at leaky buildings, what we call the building envelope, to make sure the conditioned air doesn't get out. And so, you make your buildings as efficient as possible. And then at the scale that Mike and I operate, a very important aspect are the building controls. The buildings now are smart. They turn themselves on. They turn themselves off. They know when you're there. They know when you're not. And we save tremendous amounts of money just through implementing smart building controls.
The 17 campus UNC system also adopted fairly aggressive energy and carbon reduction goals. When did you do that, and how do you do that? What exactly do you mean by carbon reduction, I guess, is a good place to start.
Yeah. Well, there's something called the President's Climate Commitment, and it's presidents as in college and university presidents. And hundreds of universities across the campus have signed on to this President's Climate Commitment. And in North Carolina, Mike, how many colleges would you say have signed this?
It's definitely a majority of the 17. And we maybe another way of saying is we have a sustainability policy. We're all supposed to have a goal. We're supposed to have carbon goals. Mm-hmm. So whether your president signed that commitment or not, you have to do some of the major steps.
Right. So the idea is, and this is driven by students. I mean, the students are demanding that these campuses focus on sustainability and energy issues. And so on our campus, 5 years ago, we made the president's climate commitment, and we are working towards what we call climate neutrality. And that is a giant goal. I mean, to say you're climate neutral, we don't imagine we'll get there until like the year 2050. I mean, you have one student drive a gasoline-powered car to campus, you're not carbon neutral. So
climate neutral and carbon neutral is the same thing?
Yes, they are.
Okay.
Yeah. Now, the other thing that will come into that is sometimes you'll do activities that are said to be offsetting. And so sometimes you can't avoid that you have a carbon footprint associated with something you've done on campus, but you may build a solar farm or you may put some land in conservation that has a forest in it that will mediate carbon. So sometimes you do things that have a negative effect to help make up for I mean, a positive effect to make up for a negative effect.
Now, we've talked a lot about sustainability, and I'm sure everybody listening knows what carbon neutrality means. But just on the off chance that they don't know, if you're burning anything, if you're using any form of energy that is derived from fossil fuels, natural gas, oil products, etc., coal, we're talking about burning carbon, correct?
Correct. And, you know, all the fuels you just mentioned imply you're burning something. And when it burns, it emits CO2. And so when we use electricity at home, if it's fired by a coal plant, for example, they are burning coal. And the burning of that coal, you know, emits carbon dioxide.
So system-wide, throughout the University of North Carolina system, how much solar, how much wind, how many alternative forms of energy are being employed right now?
It's fairly limited, and some of that, you know, is a legislative challenge in North Carolina as far as what we're allowed to. We have pretty strict rules about who can generate electricity in North Carolina. Appalachian State, I believe, probably has the most ability there. The last comment I'll make in that regard is a lot of that's very dependent on where your campus is. For example, our Charlotte campus probably, you know, is not a great site for wind generation. Okay. So, you know, when people say, how come we don't have a wind turbine like Appalachian State? It's, you know, it's partly our geography and our setting and the lack of wind.
Right.
So that wouldn't make a good investment for us. But Jed?
Well, let's talk about wind, because I know App State has a 100-kilowatt wind turbine on the campus, and you also take advantage of about 30 kilowatts of solar power up there. Wind power, where it has been installed, at least when it's talked about being installed, particularly in the east, most specifically in North Carolina off the coast, there seems to be some resistance to it. I don't want those big old windmills out there destroying my view of the ocean or destroying my view of the mountains. And they make noise, and maybe birds fly into them inadvertently, and they get killed. Do you have a lot of resistance? And how many turbines do you have? One?
We have one wind turbine at Appalachian State. It's, you know, 100 kilowatts. It's 150-foot tall machine. So on scale, it's not a huge machine, and 100 kilowatts provides, you know, less than, you know, half of 1% of our university's load.
Does it power a building? Does it power a...
It powers that part of our campus. You know, actually, it's closest to our chancellor's residence. So, you know, we put the electricity directly onto the grid, so it's hard to know where the electrons go, but we often say it powers our chancellor's house.
Okay. So do people, was there resistance about it? Because you live in a beautiful area, and people don't want things to spoil that.
Well, you know, you've hit on something really important. I mean, you know, wind is very controversial because of the perception of it might mar the landscape.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, certainly, if I had the chance to look at a mountain or a wind turbine, I would choose to look at a mountain. But it's really about perspective. You know, we ride around every day and we look at telephone poles, but we don't see them. We see cell phone towers on mountaintops, but we don't see them. We see big box stores all the time, but we don't notice them. We become very acclimated. And so, you know, as a society, we're going to have choices to make. What we have found with the wind turbine on our campus, and there's research that shows when a wind turbine is proposed in an area or a wind farm is proposed in an area, typically support for wind energy is about 70% to 80%. But when it gets proposed in your backyard, that support goes down to like 30% or 40%. And then when it gets built, Mike, that support goes back up. So what we're finding is after they get built, people were like, oh, that wasn't such a big deal. But it's natural to be alarmed at something new on the landscape.
Well, I've driven through those enormous wind farms they have out in the western states, and I actually pulled over to the side of the road because I was in the midst of this, and I thought, these things are supposed to make a lot of noise. What does this sound like? And I rolled down the window. I heard nothing.
Yeah.
And I think they're elegant. But that's just me.
Well, beauty's in the eye of the beholder. And honestly, wind turbines shouldn't go everywhere. There are beautiful places on our planet that they shouldn't be. There are places that are culturally significant. I mean, so I'm not an advocate to say you put them everywhere, but I think it's an important discussion that we have, and I appreciate you for bringing it up.
Well, now, it's not always windy, even in the mountains. So are there times when that wind turbine is not generating any electricity?
Absolutely. In Boone, North Carolina, we actually produce more energy during the winter from wind, and we produce more energy at night than we do during the days, is what we know from the data. You know, and what you're hitting on is one of the weaknesses of renewable energy technology. You know, it's not always sunny for solar panels. It's not always windy for wind turbines. And so that's why, you know, you're hearing a lot about storage technologies and large-scale battery technologies. And in the future, when we're able to pair large-scale batteries with these intermittent wind and solar resources, you know, that's when we'll truly be able to create the stable grid using renewable technologies.
And you at UNC Charlotte have the largest fleet of electric vehicles in North Carolina. Who knew? You have 150 electric vehicles. When did they come online?
So a lot of this was kickstarted by the state. They had a petroleum reduction program. So we were supposed to show that we were going to use less petroleum. And one of the ways you could do that is substituting in an electric vehicle where you were doing the job previously with a gas-powered vehicle. UNC Charlotte's campus is you know, very friendly to electric vehicles. We have 20-mile-an-hour speed limits. We have nice small roads. So, you know, nobody needs to go fast.
What kind of vehicles are they? These are more than golf carts, right? I mean, what kind of
vehicles? Some of them a lot of them are basically modified, beefed up. People do compare them to golf carts because it is a big battery pack.
Right.
But we are trying to get into more and more vehicles. In fact, one of the things we find is that sometimes there's a service need that, you know, takes a pickup truck. And so we're starting to get into vehicles that take this up to more standard-looking vehicles. I'll say one of the reasons you can and I say this having worked part of my career up north. Up north, we had to buy much beefier vehicles because we needed them to be able to, for example, heat the interior cabin during the winter.
Cold in Wisconsin.
And here, you just need to get out of the wind in the wintertime. I mean, the vehicles were – we don't get complaints from the users saying they're uncomfortable using them. Mm-hmm. Usually, it's more just they can't carry something big that needs to get carried.
Well, of course, the big argument here, and I think it's because electric vehicles are such in their infancy at the moment, is are we really helping the environment if we were to switch over to electric vehicles today en masse, would we be helping the environment? No, we're not building gasoline. I mean, we're not burning gasoline or diesel anymore, so that would be a good thing. But we are deriving our electric power, downloading it from a grid where a lot of it's produced by coal-fired plants. So are we really helping the environment?
There's a couple of analysis that have been done because this is another common statement.
Well, let me hold you there because I didn't realize we're coming up to a break. We're coming up to a break, so we need a long explanation of this because I want an electric car and I want to make sure I'm not making a mistake here. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Bradley Arendt Bolt Cummings LLP, a full-service law firm whose lawyers are industry professionals experienced in serving the banking and financial services industry in Charlotte and throughout the nation. Details at babc.com. Coming up next at 10 o'clock on the Diane Rehm Show, according to a recent national poll, businessman Donald Trump has a double-digit lead in the Republican presidential field. We'll look at what's behind his strong appeal. That's the Diane Rehm Show, coming up next at 10, right after Charlotte Talks, on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE. There are now more ways than ever to stay in touch with 90.7 WFAE. To see the latest headlines or hear in-depth reports from WFAE and NPR, go to WFAE.org or use the free WFAE app. You can also stay in touch with Charlotte's NPR news source and Charlotte Talks on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram.
In an ever-accelerating world with ever-faster communication, NPR's Morning Edition slows the news down.
We're going to be doing this all day. Let's work through what happened in what order as best you know right now.
Take a second look, ask one more question, and own your morning. Tomorrow with Morning Edition from NPR News.
Morning Edition, weekdays from 5 until 9, here on 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking to Jed Moody, the special assistant to the chancellor at Appalachian State University and the director of the Appalachian Energy Summit, which was July 13th, 14th, and 15th on the campus up there. And Dr. Michael Lizotte is the university sustainability officer for UNC Charlotte. I just asked a question about if we were to switch to electric vehicles, and for those who have some electric vehicles in their fleet, you have 150 of them at the university. Are we helping the environment? Because most of the electricity is being generated in many places by coal-fired plants.
So this has been looked at by a couple of groups. One of my favorites is the Union of Concerned Scientists, who, as their name suggests, they look into these societal questions and try to apply a scientist's approach to it. When they looked at it, and this was a study only 2 years ago, they found that in every single state in the United States, the electric vehicle was causing less pollution than the gasoline-powered, an equivalent gasoline-powered vehicle. And so, and that's despite the fact that across the United States, there are some places where we burn a lot more coal, or some places where we harvest more wind or use hydropower and so forth. So that was one study. Another angle that is often discussed in this is that if you do a fair comparison between a gasoline-powered car and an electric-powered car, what you're really comparing, they call it well to wheels. So include all the costs of getting that energy. And so, yes, we have the pollution that might be produced at a power plant, but when we burn gasoline, we have to go all the way back to the refinery. And it turns out that just the electricity used at a refinery alone to make the gasoline is more than the electricity you'd be putting in your electric car. So right there, the electric car wins before the gasoline even makes it to the gas station here.
You just did the money sign with your fingers, Jed.
Well, the electric cars run more efficient. Yeah. They require less bulk energy to run the car. And if you were to get this electric car you're dreaming of, as Mike says, you will be kinder to the environment, but you will also save money. The BTUs that you purchase to put in to your battery pack for your car will cost you less per mile than the gasoline that you're buying at the pump.
And there are no oil changes for an electric car. Now, the UNC system wants to be carbon neutral by 2050. What does that mean?
It means that we've got a lot of work to do, and it is a goal that guides us to use less energy wherever possible, to use less water wherever possible, to get people out of cars, to use alternative transportation solutions. I mean, you really have to look at everything you do.
And your energy summit, the Appalachian Energy Summit, is carbon neutral.
Absolutely.
How do you accomplish that in 2015 with the goal of being system-wide carbon neutral by 2050? How are you doing that?
Well, this is where skeptics may look at that and say, well, I don't get it. I mean, the reality is we have 400 people coming from across the state and the nation. Mm-hmm. There's a carbon footprint associated with that. We're going to cool the building. There's a carbon footprint associated with that. We are actually working with a local company in Charlotte to calculate what is the carbon footprint of that event, and then we will take donor money and go out and buy what are called carbon offsets, and we will give money to help make sure that projects that turn landfill gas methane into electricity. So we are creating a positive environmental effect with money we're spending.
Now, that's something that institutions do on a regular basis. Governments do it on a regular basis. Can individuals do that, too? If you're really concerned about the environment and you want to be as carbon neutral as humanly possible, can you do that as an individual?
Can you buy carbon offsets?
Yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, first let me say that as a state institution, we don't have state dollars to buy carbon offsets. So that's not something we're doing. This is donor money that we're doing because it's an example we want to set. But, yes, individuals can go to websites like TerraPass, and there's lots of places you can go and buy carbon offsets. Be advised that they come in lots of flavors. They come in lots of prices. And make sure you research the carbon offsets you're buying and that you are doing the good you hope to do.
Another thing that the Appalachian Energy Summit wanted to try to accomplish was to be a zero-waste event. I'm not sure I understand what that means. I think I do, but I think it's remarkable if it's true, if what my perception is true. What is that? What does that mean?
Well, when 400 people get together and, you know, we serve them meals for 3 days, and mm-hmm. so, you know, there's lots of, you know, we're not going to give you a paper plate. You know, we're giving everybody a reusable mug that we want them to use throughout the conference.
No plastic flatware.
No, and you know, anytime we do use a throwaway product, it's compostable, and we'll compost it on our campus.
Well, that, of course, leads to a question. If you're not using paper plates and plastic forks and styrofoam cups, you're giving people a mug that they want to be reused, et cetera, and you're putting things on actual plates. That means you got to wash that stuff. How much energy is used in the washing with hot water and soap and the sewage that is created by that has to be cleaned up before it goes back into the water system? How much energy is really saved by doing that?
So, well, this is a good example of where sometimes our different green goals mm-hmm. cross over each other.
Mm-hmm.
So the zero waste goal is usually defined as we're not sending anything to the landfill or the incinerator. And if you're not careful, you might actually use more energy, you know, and be confounding your carbon goals or your energy goals. So that's actually probably a good definition of how Jed and I spend some of our time as sustainability officers is negotiating between these things and making sure when we achieve one goal, we're not undermining another one that we have.
Mm-hmm.
But to answer your question, a lot of things that we've been doing on the university is to try and make sure that we're driving energy and water and all of these things down, conserving them as well. So our dining facilities have, along with contractors that we have, like at UNC Charlotte, we work with Chartwells, a Charlotte company, with a national footprint. And they are ruthless at trying to drive a lot of these energy costs out of even things as mundane as dishwashing so that water gets recycled and we turn the temperatures down or we do what we can with cold water.
Does it take scientists, mathematicians to do those calculations to figure out where we're actually saving energy and where we're even with the best of intentions, we're not burning more energy? Or can an average person do this? Will we learn to do this eventually? Will there be apps on our phones that will help us do this?
Well, help's a key word there. So, you know, just the same way that we're not all as individuals going to be good accountants
right.
or scientists or make all of these arguments. We haven't talked a lot about all these social impacts, but that's a whole specialty as well. And so, yeah, we're all going to need help. We're going to need guidance. We're going to need to know that these are better choices. A lot of what Jed and I work with, we're often called change agents. So we have to work a lot with trying to create a new norm
mm-hmm.
so that, because that often is the easiest, broadest way to do it. So that if everybody thinks it's normal to turn the lights off when they leave a room or to bring their own bags when they go shopping, then we will be able to eliminate certain problems.
Which takes us back to the university, because at a university, I guess your biggest population is the student population, and it's a university is really a small town or a small city in many cases if you have enough students. These are people who have a lot of things on their mind, even aside from their studies. So how do you get them to turn off the light when they leave the room? How do you get them not to crank the air conditioning up to the point where it feels like a deep freeze if they're in there in the summertime, or crank the heat up because they just came in at App State, for instance. It's snowing and it's cold, and they're cold. They crank the heat up in the dorm so they get warm again. How do you get them not to do that?
Well, you know, when you said earlier, it is a technological challenge, and it does require different mindsets. And so what you're talking about is the role of higher education. You know, the students that are on our campuses today are going to be the leaders of tomorrow. Mm-hmm. So we have one of the reasons I do this job is we get to be educating the future. Now, the students walk in the door more committed to these issues than the older generation that's running the campus. But the opportunity that Mike and I have and all of our peers and the people that run these campuses, we understand the technology. We know how to implement building controls or zero waste type. So what we have found is when we make these methods and these technologies available, the students embrace them. And by educating the future on these campuses, we think that the impact is going to be felt 5 to 10 years down the line. And the changes that we're seeing around sustainability and energy, I promise you, are going to accelerate at an amazing rate as these students leave our campuses and go out into positions of power.
At the Appalachian Energy Summit, you served meals with all local organic content. Why is that important to energy savings?
Yeah. Well, all of the, we're getting local and organic wherever possible. It is a high percentage, but anything local is going to be better from an energy standpoint. It has to travel less miles. It supports local economies. When food is made close by and organic, it is made in manners that's less harmful to the environment. The food is more nutritious.
Because pesticides and inorganic fertilizers take energy to produce.
Most fertilizers are derived from natural gas.
Yeah. UNC Charlotte has taken a very close look at food on campus, from what you'll buy to serve in the dining halls to how it's served to students, and your encouragement that they take only what they will eat, and you've eliminated trays. Talk about all of that. Why?
Yeah, so this actually is another good example where there's multiple goals in here. I mean, one of the things we want to help students with is not gaining weight, is the old freshman 15. So there's a goal that's already there. For example, Chartwell's has a dietitian that helps work on that sort of thing. And we find that sustainability fits in really nicely with that because if we don't have trays, that's one more item we don't have to dishwash. And it turns out that if you take the tray away, students don't overload that tray and then throw the food away when they get full. Mm. They get up from their seat and go get seconds if they are still hungry. So nobody's going hungry.
And that's exercise, right?
And that's a little exercise, right? So we find that there's always an adoption issue when students first come in, and I also say, we have to be reasonable with these things. Often, if you say we have a trayless dining facility, sometimes when we have a summer camp of middle schoolers, we'll bring the trays out to reduce the amount of cleanup that has to happen. But the other thing I was going to mention earlier, when we have goals like zero waste or trayless, those are aspirational goals in the sense that we want to get there. That's 100%. But we're reasonable managers, and if we can get 90% there, you're probably hearing that in Jed and I's voices when we talk about most of the things we're doing.
So the things that you're doing, things like trayless dining and the concept of not taking more than you're going to eat, those are things that students can take with them through life. Employees can take with them and put them into active use in their daily lives when they go home, correct? And what kind of an impact does that have as you go forward?
We're catching these students at a pivotal point in their lives. You know, they're learning to live away from home. This is their first time being on their own. And when we can instill habits around energy and transportation and the way they eat and the way they treat each other, I mean, this is such an important time in their developmental place that's why the higher education job is so key.
App State has a master plan, and among the recommendations found in that plan is to work with Apple CART, that is the local transit system up there, and the Charlotte area transit system, CATS, as well as other transportation systems around the state, to introduce regional service to the city of Charlotte. This is news to me. What are you doing, and why are you doing it?
I don't know the name of the bus system, but there is a bus that runs back and forth between Boone and Charlotte, mm-hmm. and also between the Triangle area as well. And so, you know, our students come from these population centers. And so if you want to come to Appalachian State, you don't need a car. We have a bus that travels multiple times between these locations. It's very low cost. I know it used to be $6. The bus has Wi-Fi on it, and it's available to anyone. To get back and forth to Boone. Mm. We have car sharing systems. We have ride sharing systems. Our bus system is free to anybody that steps on it. So we're trying to say you don't need a car at Appalachian State.
You're also considering things like building orientation and landscaping when you're talking about being green and being sustainable. Why is that important?
Well, this is another one of those advantages of being still actively building the campus is we can start to think about these things. I mean, building orientation helps you with your ability to use daylight. So, you know, having windows in the right places. And so we do a lot of that just in the sort of design of the buildings. Again, we have a lot of legacy buildings, and sometimes those are just oriented
wrong
by where exactly. And so those have some challenges. But if you were to visit, for example, EPIC, you know, that's a state investment, the Energy Production and Infrastructure Center, a LEED Gold building on the UNC Charlotte campus, you'd find a big courtyard, lots of light.
I want to ask again, is the University of North Carolina system, because of App State's Energy Summit over the years and your commitment to this, are we way ahead of other university systems in other states?
Yes, I would say that we are.
So that's a good thing.
It's a very good thing.
That's Jed Moody, who is a special assistant to the Chancellor at Appalachian State University and the director of their fifth annual Appalachian Energy Summit. Dr. Michael Lazat is also with us from the University of North Carolina, Charlotte, where he is University Sustainability Officer. Hope some people can take some of the things that we've talked about and that you talked about during your Energy Summit into their own personal lives. Thanks for the hour.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Charlotte Talks with Mike.